got a Bible, turn with me to Luke chapter 1. I know I've mentioned it a couple times. I'm not sure exactly where I've mentioned it, but we're next four Sundays, we're going to spend our time in this Christmas account that Scripture has for us. When you've preached Christmas more than 20 times, you start trying to make sure that you approach it in a way that is fresh for yourself. I think there's a danger that we can just sort of, you know what, we've heard this story. Some of you could recite this story. And the amazement of what's taking place here can get lost. So in the pastoral world, there's a danger that happens when you kind of keep coming back to the same thing. So every year I've tried to just challenge myself, for even if it's just for me, to make sure my approach to it is fresh and challenging to me. And I stumbled on what I am going to do over these next number of weeks, somewhere around a month ago, although I warned the early service. My comparison is to perhaps how it feels for those of you who do the cooking in your homes day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, that maybe at some point, I'm just imagining this because in my home I don't do much of this, but I imagine that it starts to feel boring, or just you're looking for something. It's like, duh, just another meal, just another piece of chicken. And I know every once in a while Linda will feed me something and then, like, you know, step back to see if I realized the new thing, spice, herb, whatever it was. My palate is very, very uneducated. I can tell chicken apart from steak, but I will not be able to tell one spice apart from another. It's probably disappointing to cook for. So all that to say, what I'm going to do over these next 4 weeks might be for some of you like the spice that you can't taste in your chicken. It just might not even register. For you, I still hope the Christmas story is a joyful thing. For the rest of you who might appreciate this, here's what I'm going to do. There is a term in literature called a hapax legomenon, which it's a Greek term, but it applies broadly in literature. It means basically a rare word, specifically like a one-off word. So if an author was to write a book and use one word one time, that's abbreviated as a hapax, meaning it's a rare word. Now, I got thinking of the Christmas story and sort of thought, I wonder, are there any words used through this story in that way? Now, this is kind of what excites me. I know, like I said, it's a spice. Some of you are going, I don't like that one. And I discovered that there's actually a number. And so what I want to do over these Sundays leading up to Christmas is take you through the passages, not just the one word thing, but through the passage that these words show up in. Surprise, surprise, it's basically the Christmas story. I know some of you are going to go, all that to just preach you the Christmas story. Yes, but for me, it just brings a little bit different flavor. And so that's what we're going to be doing over these number of weeks. So this morning we're in Luke chapter 1, looking at the first part of the Christmas story, where there's actually four of these words. In fact, Luke, interestingly enough, Luke, of all the Bible authors, he does this more than anyone else. He does it over 800 times, where he just pulls out the most unusual, rare words as he writes the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, 800 unique words, where it's like he's got something to say, but a regular word just won't quite work. And so he looks for just that unique, nuanced word to get across what he wants to get across. I look at them as sort of like those rare jewels. It must be important if he's going to pull out that kind of word. And so that's kind of where we're going. By the way, as you read through the Christmas story, perhaps you'll read through Luke. We have that tradition in our family. You get to Christmas and we read through these stories. Just be aware of one of the things that Luke wants you to really be aware of, which is his focus is going to be on Judea, on Jerusalem. There's a reason for it. There's a theological reason for the structure Luke has that's a little bit different, say, than some of the other Gospels. This isn't the sermon yet, so don't stop your watches here. But like, say, for example, in verse 5 of chapter 1, he starts off in the days of Herod, king of Judea. So he plants us in Judea, which is curious because most of the story surrounding Jesus will be Nazareth, Galilee, sort of around that geographical area. Most of the story does not actually take place in Jerusalem or Judea, but if you read Luke's account, you'd probably walk away feeling like it does. That's by design. And so all through the book, he keeps centering events. He keeps mentioning the events that took place in Jerusalem. Mary, when she sings the song that many of you would know as the Magnificat, she doesn't sing it until she travels to Judea, sort of oddly enough. Jerusalem, you know, for Jesus becomes the center point, not just that his birth is in that area of Judea, but that the very first story of his life, Luke records, when he's 12, takes place in Jerusalem. He's not going to start it in Galilee. He's going to get there, but he's going to start the whole thing in Jerusalem. By chapter 9 of Luke actually records for us, from that point on, Jesus has sort of set his face. He's now traveling to Jerusalem, which is, again, sort of one of those odd details to throw in there, because it's going to take Luke a full 10 chapters before he actually physically begins the journey. So he alerts us early on in the story that Jesus now has in mind Jerusalem. By chapter 19, though, he finally goes there. And then if you get to the end of the book, he concludes his account of the life of Jesus after his death and resurrection in Jerusalem, which is different than how, you know, Matthew and Mark and Luke sort of wrap up their account. Matthew, for example, doesn't even record the ending of the story that Luke takes us to. He wraps up his account of the life of Jesus in Matthew chapter 28 with Jesus still in Galilee giving the Great Commission on the mountain, but it's not the Mount of Olives where Jesus ascends at Luke 24. Luke takes Jesus and follows him back to Jerusalem, takes the disciples back to Jerusalem, and then records the specific instruction of Jesus to the disciples: I'm leaving, and when I leave, I want you to preach the repentance and forgiveness of sin starting Jerusalem. Now, that's Luke's thing. He wants you to see that. And I guess I would just ask this question: why? Why would someone who records the life of Jesus decide it's so critically important to just keep pointing you over and over and over to Jerusalem? And the answer is because Luke's wanting us to know that if you miss what takes place in Jerusalem, you've missed the story. Someone actually described the Gospel of Luke as a passion narrative, in other words, the story of the events of Jesus' death with a long introduction. You get the point? Luke's saying, I want to tell you the story of Jesus, but the story of Jesus is the story of his death and his resurrection. And you missed that. You've missed the story. Now, it's important because there's a whole lot of people in our world that love Jesus, the miracle worker, love Jesus, the teacher. They're all into that. But Luke says, if that's all you've got, you misread the whole thing. The whole thing took you to Jesus on a cross, dying for our sins and rising to life to show that death is defeated. Anyway, that's an aside. Just make sure as you look through Luke, you're aware of what he's doing there. But this morning, I want you just to consider what's going to take place in the early part of Luke as we run across our first four rare words. Now, if I was, before you look, so I hope you haven't actually looked at chapter one yet. If you looked at the headings, you're going to be really able to answer this question. If I just gave you eight details that Luke specifically mentions in his first story of the account of Jesus, and then asked you to think of who you suspect Luke's talking about, let's try it. Here they are. Number one, Luke tells us this is a story that takes place in the days of Herod, a story about a woman who is specifically described as a righteous woman, a story about an angel who will make an announcement. The angel's name is specifically pointed out as Gabriel, and he's going to announce that a miraculous birth is going to occur to a woman who has not had a child. And then he's going to go on and let them know that they need not be afraid, that the child will be a boy, and oh, by the way, you don't need to pick the name because I will tell you the name. These are all the details of this first story. Then we find out that many people are going to have joy and gladness and rejoice at this birth, and the child will be great before the Lord. If I said, who are we talking about? You would be right to say, that sounds an awful lot like Jesus. But it's not. But what's interesting about it is those details of the first story in chapter 1 are virtually identical to the details that will come in chapter 2 surrounding the birth of Jesus Christ. Except, Luke says, I'm not talking about Jesus yet. I'm talking about another woman and husband and another miraculous birth. This time, of a baby by the name of John. And oddly enough, Luke starts his Christmas story not with the Mary and Joseph and the angels and shepherds and all those sort of scenes. He starts his Christmas story with a man who has arrived at his once-in-a-lifetime moment. In fact, if I was to sort of try to give you the short version of the story, it would go something like this. There was a man named Zechariah who was a priest, which was not a particularly rare thing. There would have been around 18,000 priests organized in about 24 divisions. They would each have been on the job for 2 weeks of the year. Imagine that job, hey? You work 2 weeks of the year, and then once in your lifetime, your name is picked by lot to do the job that you were born to do as a priest, to offer sacrifice on behalf of the nation of Israel. And we pick up in Luke chapter 1, with Zechariah's once-in-a-lifetime moment. He's finally been picked. He's an old man by this point. Years and years have passed to get him to this point. He's in the temple, in fact, doing that very thing when Luke picks up the story. And as he's in the temple, an angel appears. An angel by the name of Gabriel that essentially says to him, Zechariah, God has heard your prayers. You've been praying and praying and praying for a child. God's heard. Your wife is going to conceive. You're going to have a baby boy. You're going to give him the name John. He is going to be a unique child. He'll be marked off in terms of uniqueness in a number of ways, but he's unique because of the purpose he has, which is essentially to prepare the way for the Lord. Your son, Zechariah, is going to prepare the way for Yahweh to meet his people and to prepare the people to meet Yahweh. Now, Zechariah's response is a little bit disappointing. Actually, it's a lot disappointing. You can read about it there in verse 18. He simply, this is his reply. How shall I know this? Let me translate that for you. I don't believe you. Like, what kind of evidence are you going to give? Which is, it's probably very human. You've probably had the same kind of responses I know I have in response to God finally answering prayers sometimes that have been there for years. And it's like, really? Like, are you sure, God? How can this be? It's a response of disbelief. In fact, in case you wonder, are we reading that right? Is that really what he means? The angel Gabriel instantly responds, because of your disbelief, here's what's going to happen. It's a happening both of judgment and of convincing. It's like, Zechariah, if you want evidence that this is God, I'm going to give it to you. But it's going to come in the form of judgment for the next 9 months at least. Zechariah will be struck mute. Now, there's a funny little part to that, because when the priest came out of the temple, he's alone in the temple doing his things. Luke tells us there's a multitude of people outside waiting, because when the priest is done, he gets his once-in-a-lifetime moment. He's going to come out of the temple, and he gets this once-in-a-lifetime moment to recite the blessing over the nation of Israel. Let me ask you this. If you were going to be once-in-a-lifetime, how many times would you have practiced? I'm thinking, many? Now, Elizabeth, you just sit here and listen. I'm going to just try it one more time. It's like, no, we've done this 100 times. You'll be fine. No, I need to get this right. I only get one chance. There's no do-over. I'm not going to get called ever again. This is my once-in-a-lifetime moment. You hear the implication. Zechariah, you're not going to be able to speak. You remember that once-in-a-lifetime moment? You just lost it. But Zechariah, there's a bright side to this. It's also the evidence that this whole thing is of the Lord. You wanted your proof? You wanted to know how you could know? Here it is, Zechariah. You won't be able to speak, but your wife's going to have a son. Now, that's the initial story there from verse 5 to about verse 25. After that comes the miraculous announcement to Mary, that she's going to have a child. And then we see later on in chapter 1, verse 57, the birth of John the Baptist, which will be followed probably by where most of us start the Christmas story at chapter 2, verse 1. And you see the problem, if we get there on Christmas morning and say, okay, gather around, we're going to read the Christmas story, and we start at chapter 2, verse 1, we've actually left off a whole chapter of what Luke says is the essential story of Christmas. So from verse 57 till, verse 66, we get really the brief account of John's birth. Now, time came for Elizabeth to give birth. She bore a son. Her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced. Remember what the angel said? You're going to rejoice, and many are going to rejoice. It's all coming to fruition right here. And on the eighth day, they came to circumcise the child, and they would have called him Zechariah after his father. After all, that's what everyone did 2,000 years ago. Took the mystery out of naming your kids. It's like, what will we call him? I know what everyone does, whatever his father's name is. But his mother answered, verse 60, no, he shall be called John. That's what the angel had instructed them. A main name that means, by the way, God is gracious. It's his name. Isn't that a great name? And they said to her, none of your relatives is called by this name. And they made signs to his father, inquiring what he wanted him to be called. By the way, the first two of those hapex words occur in verse 8 and 9 of chapter 1. The third one occurs, it's a really interesting word, in verse 22. When he comes out of the temple, he can't talk. All he can do is make signs. That's what my translation translates it at. It's actually, what the word means is he winks. He comes out of the temple. I don't know how this looks. I can only imagine. He's like, how do you communicate? I just met an angel. There's going to be a miraculous birth. And my son is going to be preparing you to meet Yahweh and Yahweh to meet you. I don't know how you wink that, but evidently that's what Zechariah tries to do. They come to him now and they're trying to communicate with him. And verse 63 says, he asked for a writing tablet and wrote, his name is John. And they all wondered. And immediately his mouth was opened. So this is Zechariah, and his tongue loosened, and he spoke, blessing God. And fear came, now pay attention to the language of this, on all their neighbors, and all these things were talked about through all the hill country of Judea, and all who heard them laid up in their hearts, saying, what then will this child be? Did you catch all the alls? It may be worth circling. I think, Rob, do we have that map of the hill country of Judea? This is actually a geographic description. So if you lived 2,000 years ago and someone said, oh, this is all the hill country of Judea, it's like, well, bang, there it is. That's it. So you see up in the top right, we got Jerusalem, where Zechariah would have been on duty. But he didn't live there. He would have probably, most likely, we think, lived in Hebron, which I don't actually know if it's on the map. I should have checked after first. I can't see. But if it is, it's right down almost directly south of Bethlehem. Which here's the interesting thing about that. That means that after Zechariah and Elizabeth leave Jerusalem, and all this has happened, they walk right through Bethlehem on the way home. And then all the hill country of Judea, what do? They all talked. And they all talked with their neighbors. And all who heard it did what? They laid it up in their hearts and wondered, what's God doing? Who is this child? Now bear in mind that in a few months' time, another woman will give birth. God will providentially relocate this woman to Bethlehem for this event to take place. Does it not seem interesting to you that God has prepared this whole region to already be doing this? Like, what is going on? Who is this child? Did you hear there was an angel showed up, it was a miraculous thing, announced that there's going to be a boy, and then it happens again. Because God's been preparing the way for this child to point to Jesus. The whole thing is going to point to Jesus. And we need to make sure we're reading Luke's account so we understand where the exclamation point lies, where the focal point lies, because Luke wants to make sure that as he writes to this man, Theophilus, he points him to Jesus Christ. And he points him not to Jesus Christ just as a historic figure in the past. He begins his book when he says in chapter 1, verse 1, he says to Theophilus, he writes him, here's what he says, Theophilus, I want to give you a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us. That's a great verb for those who love verbs. Okay, verb lovers? Probably most of you. You're going to use them all day. So in Greek, there's two ways Luke could have done this. He could have just used the past tense. He didn't. This is brilliant. So let's just get sort of geek-like for just a moment. Had he done that, had he used the aorist tense, it just would have meant this was a past tense thing, it's happened, it's done, it's completed. He uses a perfect tense, which means something happened in the past, Theophilus, but it has ongoing effects for us even today. Isn't that great? Theophilus, the story I want to tell you is a story about Jesus. And oh yeah, it's already happened, so I can tell you what took place. But Theophilus, the point is not just this is a historic thing to learn facts about and, you know, impress your neighbors. Theophilus, this is a story that if you understand it, it's going to transform your life. It's a story in the past with ongoing effects. And so Theophilus, we need to understand, we need to get to the right point and understand what this story is all about. And Theophilus, I'm going to start you with John, because if you got John right, you're going to understand who Jesus is. Now, what would we lack without this story? That's the question I had for myself as I thought, okay, my temptation, like I said, is to start the Christmas story in chapter 2. In fact, not only is it a temptation, I know I have done it on Christmas mornings. Okay, kids, gather around, let's read the Christmas story. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus. As though somehow the story starts in chapter 2. But who does that in a book? Who just goes, you know what? We're just going to skip chapter 1. We'll make a literary judgment that it's not important. We don't do that. The story started in chapter 1 with John the Baptist. What do we lose? Okay, here's three things that I think we would lose by doing that. Firstly, we would lose the story of Zechariah and Elizabeth, which is in and of itself an amazing story of how God cares for this couple who have lived through some hard things. And we don't even have to guess on that, because Elizabeth, with her own lips, tells us that what she has lived is disgrace. That's how it's felt to her, not being able to have a child. And then God has worked and heard their prayers and done some amazing things. But you want to know what we would have missed in not getting that story right? We would have missed the fact that God created a situation of absolute and utter weakness so that out of that he could save. And if you see that plot line through Scripture, you're going to see it repeat over and over and over again. God taking foolish, weak things to work through them for his glory. Elizabeth and Zechariah illustrate that story for us. Second thing, if we didn't have chapter 1, that we would probably misunderstand is the life and purpose of John the Baptist. Oh, we would get parts of his story elsewhere in the Gospels and little bits and pieces. We could probably try to string some things together. But Luke chapter 1 gives us the complete understanding of why he has come and who he is and what his mission is and why God sent him. Not only just the name, you know, God is gracious, which helps us understand, okay, this is what God is doing. His whole life, this whole event, this whole situation is the grace of God, not just for this couple, Elizabeth and Zechariah, although we're specifically told they will have joy. That's another way of just saying grace for them. But the added detail of it's not just joy and grace for them, it's grace for everyone. It's way bigger than just one couple in one little town, in one little region of one little country. This is the grace of God for everyone through this man, John. Now, there's some interesting details in his story that I'll let you read and wade through, but just worth noting the specific part there in chapter 1 of what his mission will be, verse 16. He will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. He will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared. That's the word, Yahweh. That is God. John, your mission is nothing less than preparing a people to encounter the Lord, the God of everything. That's John's mission. Now that becomes pretty important, because all of a sudden, if you read through the story, the account of John, who does he prepare the way for? We've just been there in John chapter 1 and 2, right? The other gospel, where John's like, that's him. He's the one I prepared for. That's the one that must become greater so I can become less. You put the pieces together, what's John telling us? You look at Jesus, you're looking at the Lord. And John's not the only one to see that. Listen to how John's own father, at the moment of his birth, celebrates, all right? So if you've kind of had that sort of moment, and you have your children, and there's this joy, what goes through your heart as a parent? Isn't it just like absolutely proud of your child? Listen to how John's dad celebrates. I'm in Luke 1, verse 67. And his father, Zechariah, so this is after the birth, and his father, Zechariah, was filled with the Holy Spirit. So this is God in him. and prophesied, saying, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel. That's a good start. Like, I've had a baby boy. Oh, God, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people. Still a good start. Visited me. Look at verse 69. And has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. Okay, this is for our Bible school grads. If you are a priest, do you remember which house you have to come from, which tribe? You're a Levite. Why is he singing about a different family line? Because that's our first moment in Zechariah's song where we realize he's not singing about his son. Like, why at the birth of your son would you burst out in song, a blessing to God, and then start talking about the one who's coming from the house of David, who's the horn of salvation? Because you know who he's singing about? He's singing about a son that is about to be born to Mary. That to me is astounding. You see, we wouldn't start to see and understand who John is and what his role is going to be, that even his father understands the role of his son. He's not to be the focal point. Oh, people are talking and wondering and questions going around of who is John and what's he doing. But even Zechariah knows through the inspiration of the Spirit of God that his son is there to prepare the way for one much, much greater whose sandals he's not even fit to untie. I think the shepherds get this more than anyone else. You go read their story. They met the angels, the heavenly hosts on the hillsides that night. And we find out that the whole scene is filled with the glory of the Lord. Infinite brightness. And then the angels, they burst into song. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among those whom his favor filled. For unto you is born. Remember this little song? For unto you is born one who is Christ the Lord. Can you imagine being one of those angels? It's like, the glory of the Lord is around us. We've just been instructed by the angels that tonight, in the town of Bethlehem, where we're about to go, one who is born tonight is Christ the Yahweh. How would that even have computed? And yet that's what's going on. That's what John is preparing the way for. He's preparing the way for God to meet his people. Now, the last thing we would not know if we took out chapter 1 from our Bible, we would have no grasp of the immense work God put into preparing for this moment. In fact, I would argue that all of human history prepared for this moment. So you'll prepare over these next number of weeks, probably for some sort of family thing. Maybe you're already preparing and you're trying to make sure everything's ready and the house is decorated and the food's there and everyone's invited. Does it not seem to you that the depth or the height of preparation kind of work in conjunction with the seriousness or the greatness of the celebration? In other words, the bigger the celebration, the more preparation. Like, dinner on Tuesday night for many of us is probably going to be just, we'll be happy if there's food. We don't need a big invite list. There doesn't need to be a big menu, fancy things planned. But if Christmas dinner is like that, probably be a little disappointing, no? Because that's a special thing. Right? In the early service, I was bugging Orlin and Margot because it's their anniversary tomorrow. And I didn't ask how many years. How many years are we celebrating?
47.
47 wonderful, joyful years that you're going to celebrate with us putting up a tent. And isn't it fitting that all this preparation going into having all of us here, we're going to set up a tent for your anniversary, right? I hope that there is some other celebration aside from that. I suspect there will be, because that's just how we do things. The bigger the event, the bigger preparation. So let me ask you this. If God has been working for all of human history to prepare for something, does that not strike you that that might be the most important event in human history? So let's just think of the preparation that took place. Let me just point out a couple things here. I'll let you explore more of them on your own. But just think of the connection of this story back through the Old Testament for a minute. If you get to Luke chapter 2, you start to see some things pop off the page. Because after Jesus is born, Mary and Joseph do a series of things that for us maybe sound a little bit odd, but for a Jewish person 2,000 years ago would have sounded very normal, in fact, expected. They take their child to the temple at a certain number of days. He's circumcised, and then they offer this sacrifice or offering. We find out they offer a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. What they're doing, if you were to go back to Leviticus 12 and some of these Old Testament passages, is they are following the instruction that Moses gave of exactly what you did when you had a child. For those who kind of like to understand some of the details, in fact, they're following the instructions for what you did if you were living in poverty and had a child. And it's one of those moments where you realize, you know what? 1,500 or 1,600 years earlier, when God was working through Moses and building a nation and preparing all of this, he had this moment in mind. When you start digging further into this story, there's another interesting connection that starts coming out. The connection back to a boy named Samuel, and his mother named Hannah, who was a woman in a very similar situation to Elizabeth and Mary in many regards, hadn't had a child, and then God did an amazing, wonderful thing, and she had a boy. And she was so overwhelmed by the goodness of God that she offered her son back to the Lord. Now, if you were to read Exodus 13 and Numbers chapter 18, you would see what she's doing. You see, because when the Israelites came out of Egypt, God had this great moment of deliverance. Remember, he struck down all the firstborn of the Egyptians, but the Israelites he saved because they did this offering. They sacrificed the lamb, put the blood above their doors. That was his instruction. So the angel of death passed over. And then when they came out, God said, okay, from now on, because I really want you to remember this, the firstborn of everything is mine, firstborn male. Whether it be animal, so if it's firstborn animal, you sacrifice it to me, or you have to redeem it back. But the firstborn son is mine. Now, obviously, God's not going to want them sacrificed, so God has a system in place where they go and they offer sacrifice to the Lord. They essentially consecrate their son to the Lord. They get their son back, but at a cost to them. What's interesting about Samuel's story is he's never consecrated. You go read the story. There's never a moment. In fact, it specifically shows us that Hannah did not go and do this. You want to know why? It's because she was not buying him back from the Lord. Every other son was. You took your offering to the temple. You gave the offering. You took your son home. Hannah didn't have to do that. Why? Because she took her son to the temple and left him. Now, Samuel is described, there's lots of descriptions. Again, I'll let you read some of these yourself. He's described as a boy who continues to grow in stature and favor with the Lord and with men, which is interesting. It's the same description Luke will use of Jesus. If you read Hannah's song of how she bursts out in prayer and talks to God in chapter 2, and then go read Mary's song, you'll see the parallels. And then we read this odd little scene of Mary and Joseph bringing their son to the temple. And every detail, according to the Old Testament law, is attended to. The offering's given. He's circumcised. Every last detail. Except he's not consecrated. There's no moment where they do this exchange. They offer the price to bring their son home. And so when you read in chapter 2, the very next story we're faced with, when Jesus is a boy, he's 12 now, and the family goes to Jerusalem for one of these religious sort of festivals, and then they leave, and they lose Jesus. You remember this story? It's like, where's Jesus? I thought you had him. No, probably as a parent, you've had your moment. I know we did. We actually left one of our kids at church once. We got about a block away. I won't tell you which. But there's this moment, and they're like, where's Jesus? And remember, Jesus answers them. When they finally find him, Jesus answers them. It's like, where else did you expect me? I'm in my Father's house. You hear what we're reading there? Is Jesus was never bought back from his Father. He belonged there. That's where he belonged. And Luke says, yep, that's where the whole story is going to take you. It's going to take you to Jesus dying in Jerusalem. And the very place where he belonged most is going to reject him. It's going to be the heart and focal point of the rejection of Christ. You see, we wouldn't see that stuff if Luke hadn't given us chapter 1 and 2. We could go on because Luke's going to point in his genealogy in chapter 3. He's going to point all the way back to Adam. He's going to, you know, like when Matthew gives the genealogy, it's just sort of, you know, these family members. And Luke's like, no, I'm going to see you and raise you five. Let's go all the way back. Because I want you to know God's been preparing for this moment. Since the moment he took some dust of the earth and made a man, God's been getting ready for Jesus. He does the same thing. Just go read where Isaiah will start to come into the account of Luke. And all of a sudden, the lights go on. It's like, oh man, everything that Isaiah was doing pointed to Jesus. And if you start to put all the pieces together, you're probably getting it right. This whole book is about Jesus. This whole universe, every minute of human history was about getting ready for him and then proclaiming the good news. Now, let me land this thing really quickly, and then one of our interns, Chase, is going to come and lead us in communion this morning. That's your two-minute warning, Chase, to pray for God's mercy and help. You're going to do awesome. We love having our interns around. I think what Luke wanted Theophilus to do is get to the end of the Christmas story and ask himself this question: will I respond like Zachariah or like Mary? He doesn't ever say it. He just sets it up. Zachariah, this man who encounters an angel and all that God's going to do, and is just left with, how do I know? Prove it to me. I can't believe. Mary, who has a totally different response. A response of faith. She does ask a question. It's not that you can't ask questions, but the question is not, prove it to me. The question is, okay, Lord, I believe. I just don't understand how this is going to happen. And I think Luke would want Theophilus to say to himself, how am I going to respond to Jesus? Am I going to respond and say, I don't think I can believe. You're going to have to prove more to me. Or will we respond in that simple act of faith of saying, I believe. I may not understand everything. I may not have every question figured out, but I believe. I will trust. And I want to leave you with that same question this morning. And one further one for a few of you. A few of you who have gone down Zachariah's path. The path of being righteous and having known God and walked with God and then having a moment of disbelief that led to months, maybe years, of not walking with the Lord. That's Zachariah's story, moment of disbelief that sort of brings an end. And see, some of us grew up in church, or we went to Sunday school, or we did youth group, and then life got busy and we got distracted, and then for some reason, God brings us back to this place. And I think it's with that question of, are you ready to believe yet? You want to know, for me, the hopeful point of Zachariah's story: after the judgment of God, God restores him. His mouth is loosened, and the first words that come out of his mouth are, blessed be God. Maybe this morning that's what you need to just think through. Are you ready to do that? Are you ready to come back to him?